This is Coast to Coast AM. Congratulations, you found us. Permission to come aboard granted. We don't require a passport or a visa. I don't even need to see your immunization record. You don't have to pass a Rorschach test. All you need is an open mind. Not so open mind. Let your brains fall out, mind you. George Norrie is off. Not true. George is never off. He's always on, spot on. I can bear witness to that after last Saturday and watching him on stage at his live event here in Toronto. But he's not in the air chair tonight. He may be standing inside a crop circle in Wiltshire, England. Perhaps he's cross-examining an alien-human hybrid working in the Department of Homeland Security. Quite frankly, I don't know. I don't have a high enough security clearance to be privy to that kind of information. But I've seen a few of the memos flying around at Coast stamped cosmic clearance. Anyway, it's a pleasure. Richard Serrett here, coming to you live from Coast's Toronto affiliate AM 640. I have to tell you, it's brisk up here. It is brisk. I thought being a Canuck, I was supposed to be made of sterner stuff, but that wind coming off Lake Ontario is like a slap in the face. And the dashboard in my Volkswagen Passat keeps chiming every time the temperature hits about 4 degrees Celsius, telling me there's a snow advisory. I'm hearing conflicting reports about, you know, what this winter is supposed to be like, this winter that's heading toward us like a rocket ship on rails. Up here, we have a government agency called Environment Canada, and they're essentially weather nerds. They're wonderful people. But they're saying this winter, at least here in the Northeast, will not be as cruel as last winter. And they're very quick to poo-poo, of course, the Farmer's Almanac, which is predicting a brutal winter, maybe the worst in 40 years. But then again, the Farmer's Almanac is basing their predictions on the width of the stripe on a woolly bear caterpillar. And I don't know, the viscosity of a jar of elk lard or something. Anyway, I got to tell you, I'll put my faith in nature before some sterile computer model. The Farmer's Almanac saying you might want to invest in some snow chains for your tires, some pocket warmers, and some earmuffs this winter. And it has something to do with all this volcanic ash in the atmosphere. And what's happened is it's caused something called the Hadley Cell winds to shift towards the poles. And of course, there's always been a polar vortex, but normally they don't come down as far into the United States as they did this past winter. And the reason they came down so far is because apparently of all this volcanic ash that's in the atmosphere. And it's going to happen again this winter. You may recall reading in the Chicago Tribune that the month of January of 2014, the median temperature in Chicago was below that of the North Pole. And we can expect more of this for years to come. Nobody seems to be talking about it. This could be the harshest winter in 40 years in the Northwest, or the Northeast rather, and much of the rest of the country can anticipate continued droughts. Not man-made global warming to blame. It's these belching volcanoes the world over. Well, it's Friday. That means open lines in the latter stages of the broadcast. And I have to tell you, Friday into Saturday morning is the right time. You, me, the telephone. It's live radio across, what is it? I don't know, 17 time zones. Anything can happen. And it usually does. And I've come to believe that Edison, Tesla, Reginald Fessenden, we'll throw in a good Canadian inventor here, Alexander Graham Bell, they all got together, somehow managing to transcend space and time, and they invented the telephone and the radio for the express purpose of open lines on Coast to Coast. Let's face it, it's an institution, a national treasure. Let's convene a constitutional convention and propose a 28th Amendment that open lines on Coast to Coast be enshrined in the Constitution. I know you'll come with your A material. That's open lines in hours 3 and 4. In the first 2 hours of the program, it's been more than 45 years since a crazed killer began terrorizing the San Francisco Bay Area with a series of grisly murders. involving someone who would identify himself as the Zodiac Killer between December 1968 and October 1969. Four men and three women between the ages of 16 and 29 were targeted. However, the Zodiac Killer would claim, at least according to his taunting letters to local media outlets, that the number of victims was actually 37. The killer originated the name Zodiac in a series of these letters sent to the local Bay Area press. These letters included cryptograms or ciphers, and of the four cryptograms sent, only one has been definitively solved. Suspects have been named by law enforcement and amateur investigators, but no conclusive evidence is surfaced. Then in April 2004, the San Francisco Police Department marked the case inactive, yet reopened the case at some point prior to March 2007. The case also remains open in the city of Vallejo, as well as Napa County and Solano County. The California Department of Justice has maintained an open case file on the Zodiac murder since 1969. There's one person, my guest in hours one and two, who, despite the passage of time, refuses to let this case go. Tom Voigt is an expert on the Zodiac Killer case and webmaster of ZodiacKiller.com, which has been online since 1998. ZodiacKiller.com is dedicated to identifying California's still at large Zodiac Killer from the late 1960s and early 70s. It's quite a website, complete with a list of possible suspects, and they are legion. Biographies of the victims, copies of the taunting and cryptic letters sent to members of the Bay Area press. You're about to meet a man who says he won't give up on the Zodiac Killer case until he's identified or he dies. My name is Richard Serrett. Thanks for inviting me into your home. Hope you'll permit me to stay a while. You're listening to Coast AM. In San Francisco, during the 1960s and 70s, the Zodiac Killer was on the loose. While the crime is still technically unsolved, Tom Voigt, an expert on the case, is convinced he knows the identity of the killer. He joins me now to discuss the case, the victims, and why the San Francisco Police Department refuses to do serious DNA testing on the letters and evidence in the murders. Tom, welcome once again to Coast AM. How are you?
I'm great, Richard. Thanks for having me on. This is my third appearance on Coast to Coast. I'm hoping that the third time will be the charm, and maybe somebody in the next 2 hours is going to call in those open lines and provide us with that missing piece of the puzzle so we can have a fourth show where we celebrate solving the Zodiac case.
You know, it's amazing that in this era of 48-hour news cycles and so much time on networks like CNN, even entire cable channels now devoted to murder trials, that the Zodiac Killer case continues to fascinate so many. And before I get you to answer why that is, let me get you to offer a brief primer course on the Zodiac Killer case, a thumbnail sketch, if you could, because there are many people listening who weren't even born during that period of history.
Well, it's going to have to be a pretty big thumbnail because it's been 45 years now, but I'll sum it up as best I can. The Zodiac was really a Batman villain come to life. He was someone who was prone to committing murder around the Bay Area, San Francisco. And this was in the late 1960s, early 1970s. And he wasn't content to just get away with killing random people, apparently random people. We don't know if he knew them or not, but he also taunted the police, and he challenged the police and the public to catch him. And that's something that you just, you know, don't ever see outside of a movie or a TV show or a comic book, where you have this bad guy that it's not enough to just get away with the crime. He's got to make it a game. And the Zodiac made it a game. He wrote letters taunting the police, and he sent cryptograms, puzzles for people to solve, which apparently contained clues to his identity. And he did this over a period of years, and nobody could figure out who he was. And he got away with it, at least up until now. But he's had a head start, a big head start, but I'm confident that we can catch up and finally identify him.
So now back to my initial question, Tom. Why do so many people, many, again, not even around in the late 60s, why are so many so fascinated with this case? And then I'll ask you about you personally.
Well, it's a really interesting story. You know, the San Francisco Bay Area back in the late 60s was fascinating all by itself with the counterculture revolution and with the hippies and all that. It's a very fascinating, beautiful place to live. It's a tourist attraction. And so to have the stark contrast of the beautiful cityscape of San Francisco and the love movement contrasted by this maniac who is apparently randomly killing people, no matter who you were, no matter where you are, you weren't safe. And the fact that he could get away with that, and to this day, and he could still be alive. He could be sitting next to you on the bus or in line behind you at the grocery store. That's just very spooky and also very captivating. It's hard for people to accept the fact that someone could do these things and get away with it in such a high-profile way. So it's fascinating. It's like a movie, except it's all real. It really happened, and so that hooks people, and it hooked me, and it's hooked millions of people. The case is so active now, not within law enforcement. Law enforcement, you know, they have a file and it's supposedly active, but the case is not actively investigated by law enforcement, but it is actively investigated by hundreds and thousands of people around the world, mostly through the internet. And they're hooked on the case and trying to solve it just as I am.
Has this essentially taken over your life? How many hours, let's say, in a typical week do you devote to tracking down leads, posting information on your website, etc.?
I'm not good at math. I can't calculate. Let's see. How many hours in a day? 24? Okay, when I'm not asleep, I'm pretty much on the computer doing Zodiac stuff, answering email, updating the website with new information. It's a passion. It's a hobby, but it's just something that I've always felt like I just need to do it. It's been since the mid-1990s. So it's been about 20 years, and I didn't feel like I had a choice. I just felt like this was something that needed to be done. Somebody needed to build a website, collect all the information, put it out there for free so everyone around the world can access the information so that somebody somewhere is going to be able to figure this thing out. And it's cost me a great deal. I'm 47. I don't have a savings account. I don't have medical insurance. I don't have good credit. I live month day to day, not even month to month. All my resources go into this case. And that's a choice I made, and I'm glad I did, because I really feel like we're going to solve this. And I feel like I'm going to play a huge part in it.
Is it personal for you? I mean, do you have a personal connection to one of the victims, perhaps?
I've always felt a strong connection to the victims. I didn't know any of them, but ever since I first learned of the case, it's been my goal to document their lives as well as possible. So I'm always thrilled when I am able to obtain a picture of one of the victims that no one's ever seen. For example, the sister of the Zodiac San Francisco victim sent me the scrapbook that the victim's mother had put together documenting his life and death. And that was something that she wanted me to have. And it was thrilling to be able to share the contents of that with people who are equally concerned about the victims. And really, it's strange. They feel like family, even though I never met them. I've always felt that connection to the victims. And that's one reason why I'm so passionate about trying to catch the bad guy that did these things.
Well, that's one of the things that I like about your website, ZodiacKiller.com, is that it's not just about, you know, trying to catch the bad guy here. It's not all about focusing on the suspects. You really are paying tribute to the victims so that they are never forgotten, even though it's been nearly 45 years.
That's correct. They're never going to be forgotten. Each of the victims, even possible Zodiac victims, not just the definite Zodiac victims, but they're all represented, and it's out there in cyberspace for everyone around the world. And it's been that way since March of 1998. So ZodiacKiller.com was there before YouTube, before Google, before Facebook, before all these internet staples. I already had the site up. And I'm proud of that. I'm proud that it's been there for so long and that the victims are so well represented. It's not just about the killer or even about catching the killer. It's about the victims, and I think the victims are going to be the main source helping catch the Zodiac, because he left something behind at each of the crime scenes, and you can tell a lot about him by they're going to be helpful in wanting to catch him.
You're convinced that the Zodiac Killer is still alive, is that correct?
I don't believe he's still alive. The best suspect I've ever seen is deceased, and he's been the subject of feature stories, television shows. He was an artist in San Francisco named Richard Gaikowski, and he's by far the most interesting suspect that I've ever seen. He died in 2004. He did many things in his life. He was a writer for the Albany, New York Knickerbocker News, the newspaper in Albany, New York. He worked there in the 1960s. He was a journalist in Martinez, California. He was a counterculture journalist in San Francisco in the late 1960s, early 1970s. And he eventually became infatuated with punk rock music and with making his own films. And he was someone that was very much in tune with his own interests and explored his own interests. He's very much an artist and a very eccentric person. And he's, in my opinion, the most qualified suspect I see to actually be the Zodiac. And he did die in 2004, but his DNA was obtained in 2009. And it's just a matter of comparing that DNA to the Zodiac's DNA. But that has been, let's just say, very frustrating to get the police involved. They're not involved.
I want to go down the list of some of the suspects, and there were thousands of Zodiac suspects since 1968. We'll go down the list, including Ted Kaczynski. Many people may not be aware that the Unabomber was at one time considered a suspect. And we'll get into Richard Gaikowski and so forth. How many leads, when you wake up in the morning and you check your inbox, I mean, how many emails with good solid leads or bits of information are you receiving on a daily or weekly basis?
A typical day, I have 100 email, maybe more. Most of it is I get a lot of kids, high school students, asking questions. They have a assignment due, and it's about the Zodiac case, and they want me to do their homework for them, essentially. And when I was in high school, we didn't have websites that had it all right there for you to put together easily. So I get a lot of that. I tend to not respond. But as far as good information, when I finally get a gold nugget, it makes all the crud worthwhile. I get a lot of crud. I get a lot of people who are out for the notoriety. They try to convince me they know who the Zodiac is, thinking that I'll back up their theory and get them a book deal. A lot of scammers contact me trying to sell me so-called evidence. But I do occasionally get a really good contact, either someone within law enforcement, someone within the FBI, maybe a relative of one of the victims, or somebody who felt like they encountered the Zodiac in the late 60s, early 70s. I get people contacting me with information about the known suspects. And occasionally I do get somebody who has information about a very compelling new suspect, and that's always exciting. But unfortunately, a lot of the people that are attracted to the case seem to be a little unstable, and I do get some very threatening emails, and there are people who are not at all rational, who probably shouldn't be on the internet, but they eventually all find me. Every kook on the internet eventually finds me, and that's always an adventure. It's a daily. I look forward to answering my email. Let's put it that way. It's always interesting.
Tom Voigt is with us here on Coast to Coast AM. Richard Serrett sitting in for George Norrie. The website, ZodiacKiller.com. Now, tell us about the MO of the Zodiac Killer. What are some of the common denominators behind these murders? And I guess there were seven officially, but the Zodiac Killer, in these taunting letters to the Bay Area press, claimed credit for up to 37 murders. So let's talk about the MO here that was sort of consistent throughout.
It was consistent until the Zodiac decided to just throw a monkey wrench in the machinery. At first, it was thought that the Zodiac was simply targeting young couples in secluded settings, and that he was therefore a loner or mad or angry because he was incapable of having his own significant relationship or whatever. So he was targeting these young people in these secluded settings, and then all of a sudden he changed everything, and he targeted a male in a very urban setting.
Okay, so, let me just jump in here, Tom. Apologies. We've got Tom Waits percolating up here, so we'll take a time out, come back, and continue this conversation. The Zodiac Killer. His identity, perhaps, to be revealed on this very program. Let's come back with more of my conversation with Tom Voigt here on Coast to Coast AM. It's one of the great unsolved murder mysteries of all time, right up there with Jack the Ripper and, of course, the Black Dahlia. We're talking about the Zodiac Killer and a man who is in fast pursuit, hoping to solve that mystery, perhaps right here on Coast to Coast AM, is my guest, Tom Voigt. More of our conversation with when Coast continues right after this. Tom Voigt is with us here on Coast to Coast AM. Richard Serrett sitting in for George Norrie. And we will open up the phone lines at the top of the hour, take calls, comments, questions for Tom. And who knows, maybe you will provide a lead that will help crack this case now some 45 years later. Tom, we were talking about the M.O. Some of the victims were shot. Some of them were stabbed. In some cases, the victims were initially there were couples in a remote area, and then he sort of switched his M.O., maybe which led to some confusion, and killed a lone male at one time.
That's right. It initially appeared the Zodiac was targeting couples, and to this day, there are people that that think he was just some you know, woman hater, or he was lonely, and so he targeted people who weren't lonely. But if you look at all the data in hindsight, then it appears the Zodiac was really just trying to put fear in people. He was initially killing young couples who ordinarily should have been safe. He did so in areas where you would most likely find young couples. And when he became labeled as just a couples killer and someone who was, you only had to fear if you were out in a lover's lane somewhere, then he came into the big city of San Francisco and killed a man in San Francisco's probably most expensive and should be safest neighborhood. So at that point, nobody knew what to expect. Nobody knew how to be safe, because even if you were alone, if you were with someone, if you were in an urban area, if you were in the country, no matter who you were or where you were, the Zodiac could get you. And that haunted people and horrified people for a very long time. And I get contacted every day by someone who has some kind of a personal recollection. It's still with them. They're still scared, and they desperately want to see the guy caught.
You lived in San Francisco for as part of your research for a year, beginning in 2004. Are people there still talking about it? Are there still people on the street who this is so fresh for them in their memory that they want to open up to you about it?
Yes, and I met with quite a few last month at the 45th anniversary on October 11th. I put together a gathering in San Francisco through my website, ZodiacKiller.com, and met with quite a few people. Some came as far away as Pennsylvania, Missouri, and local people, too, who in some cases were around in the late 60s and who were still deeply affected by what happened, and they have a strong desire to help bring the guy to justice after all these years. It's been 45 years, but at least there are amateur detectives, if not actual professional detectives, who are still on the case gathering information, and one day someone is going to have that final piece to the puzzle. You know, there were cases recently in the last 10 years that were unsolved for the longest time. The Green River Killer is one. He was finally caught, and that was a cold case. And also the BTK Strangler in Wichita was another case that some thought might be unsolvable because so much time had passed. But it doesn't really matter how much time has passed, whether it's 45 years or 50 years. The data is there. The science is there. This won't be like Jack the Ripper, which was from 1888. That would be astounding if the Jack the Ripper case got caught. Zodiac is much more current, and in fact, a lot of the original players are still alive, and the actual suspect might still be alive. So this is a case that is solvable, and if law enforcement won't do something about it, I know there are thousands and thousands of people online who are willing to take a flat.
Talk to me about these cryptic letters that the Zodiac Killer sent to the press. When did they begin, and what was? Talk to me about the content of these taunting cryptic letters.
The letters began at the end of July 1969. Although there were a few letters sent in 1967 in a different part of California that might have been the work of the Zodiac. But that's something that has yet to be fully connected. It's a possibility, a strong possibility. But the known Zodiac letters began at the end of July 1969. And interestingly, in the first letters, he did not call himself the Zodiac, but apparently he decided he needed a nickname. So he named himself, and then some people think that the press gave him that name, the Zodiac. But no, he named himself. And he continued writing his letters and calling himself the Zodiac up until early 1971, where he proceeded to disappear for a few years. But then he returned in 1974, writing his letters to the press, but not calling himself the Zodiac for some reason. But it was definitely him. The handwriting matched. And the letters were essentially just an effort to instill fear in the public and to make the police look bad. So in that sense, the Zodiac was very much a domestic terrorist. And the Bay Area, in fact, all across the country in the late 60s and early 70s, you had individuals and groups that were engaged in domestic terrorism. And what they would usually do is commit an act of violence, a bombing or a murder. They would then take credit for that act of violence, usually through a written communication, sometimes through a recording. And then they would threaten that they would commit future acts unless their demands were met. And there were groups like the SLA and the Weather Underground that followed the same formula as the Zodiac did. And the only difference between Zodiac and those groups were the demands. The SLA, for example, wanted poor people to be fed. The Weather Underground had political demands they wanted met, and so forth. Where the Zodiac's demands were very bizarre. He wanted people to wear his button and jump through all these silly hoops for him. But if you ignore what his demands were and you just look at the recipe he followed, it was urban terrorism, domestic terrorism. And that seems to be what his signature was. That terrorism angle is what Zodiac needed to get fulfillment from his crimes. He didn't need to attack couples. He proved that. He didn't need to use a gun or need to use a knife. He didn't need to attack in a lover's lane. What he seemed to need was to terrorize. And I think that's the most important piece of evidence about the Zodiac.
Were there any FBI profilers? I know that today, 45 years later, the advances in profiling individuals is just, leaps and bounds. But what sort of FBI profiling was done back then? And what was sort of the profile of this individual? Obviously a complete psychopath.
Well, they didn't really have profiling back then. The police consulted different psychiatrists and people like that, but the art of profiling hadn't quite been developed. Mainly the police were working on assumptions. They were assuming that Zodiac was crazy. They were assuming that he hated women. They were assuming that he was jealous of young couples. They were just making a whole lot of assumptions. And I think most of those assumptions, if not all of them, have turned out to be pretty obviously incorrect. As far as modern profilers, the case is really nothing that, in my opinion, modern profilers are going to be able to handle, and that's because Zodiac was so much different than every other, to label him a killer or a murderer and lump him into that category I think it's not going to do anybody any good, because again, he was really a terrorist, and because he was working alone, apparently, and because he didn't, his demands weren't such that you could really draw any good conclusions about him. I mean, if he was making political demands, then you would be able to ascertain what kind of person he might be and what his interests might be. Zodiac's demands were just so strange. I mean, wanting people to wear his special button with the Zodiac symbol on it. That's what he demanded. Wanting his codes to be published on the front page of various newspapers. You know, these weren't demands that anybody had ever seen. And so Zodiac essentially just got labeled a psycho killer, and it was left at that. But really, there's evidence to indicate that he was really not psychotic at all, and that he was not motivated by hatred or jealousy, but by his own terroristic ideals and wanting to instill fear in the public and wanting to make the authorities look inept.
Officially, there were 7 victims, but he claimed to have killed 37 people. What is the actual number of victims, do you believe, based on your research, Tom?
Well, I haven't really seen a lot of evidence to indicate that Zodiac kept killing after 1969. It's certainly possible. In my opinion, he definitely started killing prior to the official first victims. The first official victims were December 1968, and I think Zodiac was a little too polished for them to be his first actual murders. I think Zodiac started in the early 1960s. A young couple was killed on a beach near Santa Barbara, and that crime is almost identical to Zodiac's crime at Lake Berryessa in 1969. They're so similar. I think that the 1963 Santa Barbara case was a very young Zodiac getting some experience. So I do think there's evidence that indicates he started in the early 60s, but did not call himself a Zodiac and did not write letters about that particular double homicide. I do believe that there, on the other hand, is no evidence that he continued killing after Mr. Paul Stein in San Francisco in 1969, October, which was 45 years ago and 1 month approximately. So he could have, certainly, he could have kept killing and just not taken credit for it through his letters, and that's pretty scary to think about it. But there really isn't a lot of evidence to support that idea.
Talk to me about the cryptic nature of these letters. I believe there were 4 letters that contained cryptograms. Did the police employ cryptographers to try and break these codes? Tell me about that.
Well, when the codes arrived, it's funny. It was assumed that they were extremely complex and that it would take some kind of trained expert to be able to solve them. And experts were brought in. From the military and elsewhere, the government, and they tackled the code. But the code was actually solved by an amateur, a young couple, a high school teacher and his wife worked together and solved the code. And it turned out to be a very rudimentary code that a child could have put together. You know, if you ever owned a secret decoder ring back in the 40s or 50s or 60s, like in that movie A Christmas Story, when Ralphie sends away for the little orphan Annie decoder ring, you could use such a device and encode Zodiac's cipher. So it turned out to be pretty rudimentary. And so the idea that he was a cryptography genius or something, some people still think that he was for some reason, but he was obviously very intelligent. And 3 of his codes has not been solved. And that's one of the big attractions for some people, the lure of the unsolved codes. And there are 3 unsolved codes. The first one was very rudimentary, but that doesn't mean the remaining 3 are. In fact, they haven't been solved, so there must be something to them that's not easy to figure out. And the puzzles, the codes, that's something that brings in a lot of people from around the world, the people from Iceland and China that are obsessed with solving Zodiac's codes, and that will spend, you know, hours and hours and hours, and they can't give up. And it can drive, you know, some people have lost their marriages over the codes, not being able to quit trying to figure out what the codes mean, and they end up getting divorced. They end up losing their job. I know of a lot of personal stories about that. You know, it hasn't happened to me, but I can see where these codes and prospect of what they say when they're solved, and revealing this. Zodiac even claimed that solving the code would give you his name, and that's addicted people for 45 years.
Do you believe that's true? Ultimately the identity of the Zodiac killer is contained in those cryptic messages?
Well, I think he would have. It wouldn't have been as simple as solving the code and having his name right in front of you. I think Zodiac was very devious, and I think that he would have put clues to his identity throughout his letters and ciphers, but not necessarily spelled it out. I think he would have wanted to make it a little more difficult. And I think there's evidence, if Richard Gajkowski was a Zodiac, there's evidence that he did put his name in the first cipher, and that it does spell Gajkowski. And I've detailed that at ZodiacKiller.com. There's a whole section for the suspects, and the section for Richard Gajkowski is especially detailed, and it explains the code process and how you can get his name very easily in the first code, the first code that was solved by Donald and Betty Horton.
Well, let's begin to talk about some of the suspects, because one could also perhaps find the last name of another suspect, Arthur Lee Allen, or the middle name, rather, of Arthur Lee Allen in those codes. We'll be coming up on a break here, but let's begin the conversation about the suspects. Let's begin with Arthur Lee Allen, if we could, Tom. Why did he sort of become a suspect?
Arthur Lee Allen was a deviant person. He was a bit of a pervert, and people were already suspicious of his motives and behaviors even before the Zodiac crime started. He was just kind of the local pervert in the area where the Zodiac was initially active, and someone somewhere suspected that Allen could be the Zodiac, and they contacted the police, and that's what got Allen's name in the police report in the first place. And then along the way, someone came forward and allegedly. Well, they had the story that Arthur Lee Allen told them he was the Zodiac, okay? And this story captivated the police because Allen allegedly confessed to being the Zodiac before the crimes even started. And the informant was apparently credible, and it launched an entire investigation into Arthur Lee Allen and propelled him into the top suspect status. Nothing was found to ever link Arthur Lee Allen to the Zodiac crimes, but there were a lot of very suspicious things about him, and there were some interesting circumstantial bits of evidence that came out, and I'm responsible for quite a few of those things. You mentioned his middle name being in one of the ciphers, and that's something that I found back in 1998, and it was extremely compelling, and there were a lot of compelling things about Arthur Lee Allen. In fact, there were enough to make an entire movie about him, starring Robert Downey Jr. The Arthur Lee Allen character was the main villain in that David Fincher film. So he was very interesting, but science ruled him out. His DNA did not match the Zodiac. His fingerprints didn't match. His handwriting didn't match. So at the end of the day, you were left with some interesting circumstantial evidence, but nothing solid to link Arthur Lee Allen to the Zodiac crimes.
I guess the circumstantial evidence would be that he was in Riverside, California at the time when one of the first victims, Sherry Jo Bates, was killed at Riverside College, Riverside City College.
Well, I obtained Arthur Lee Allen's personnel file from the mid-1960s, and in that file was an absence slip. He had called in sick in Northern California a day after Sherry Bates had been murdered in Southern California. And apparently Sherry Bates, when she was murdered, she left some serious injuries on her attacker. And they know that because there was skin under her fingernails. So she had apparently clawed her attacker. And so when I found Arthur Lee Allen's absence slip from the day following her murder, that was very compelling. And plus, he did admit to being in Riverside the weekend she was murdered.
All right, Tom. Sure, lots of compelling evidence here. We'll delve into some of the other suspects. Back with more of my conversation with Tom Voigt, hot in pursuit of the Zodiac Killer, right here on Coast to Coast AM.